Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Danielle Del Sol and Susan Langenhennig of the Preservation Resource Center about the gorgeous new book, Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans. We'll also hear from Mickey Pfeffer, editor of A New Orleans Author in Mark Twain's Court, Letters from Grace King's New England Sojourns. And Megan Holt joins us to preview Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, coming up later this month. It's a great pleasure to welcome Danielle Del Sol, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center, along with Susan Langenhennig, Director of Communications for the PRC and editor of its magazine, Preservation in Print. They're here to talk about the PRC's gorgeous new book, Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
And Susan, you too.
Oh, thank you for having us, Susan.
So great to see you. So talk a little bit about the impetus for this book. And I particularly love that Michael Lewis in his blurbs calls it a gorgeous piece of real estate porn. It is full of beautiful, desirable buildings.
It really is.
How did you choose them?
This book has been such a long time coming. The PRC does have a storied history of book publishing. Of course, our beloved Mary Fitzpatrick wrote a beautiful trilogy dedicated to the city after Hurricane Katrina. We were so sad to lose her a few years ago. It was such a tragedy for our organization. This book really picks up on that legacy and celebrates it. We had planned to do a book initially, as our former director, Patty Gay, had stepped down, on the legacy of the PRC, because we're a 45-year-old organization and we have done so much work throughout the whole city of New Orleans, from Holy Cross to the Lower Garden District to Uptown. Our footprint is everywhere in the city. And so there's plenty that we could write about just from what PRC has done. And as Susan and I sat down and started brainstorming about the possible projects that we could feature in this story, and there's over 30 buildings featured in this story, we were overwhelmed with the amazing amount of renovations that have happened in recent years. And this book really focuses on recent renovations for the most part.
Yeah.
The quality, the variation. I mean, you have churches turned into theaters. You have, you know, just incredible adaptive reuses across the whole city. The real challenge was paring it down.
I'm sure.
But what we did was we pared it down to different categories of building projects. So really projects that were driven by the passion of people who are really kind of crazy and have the deep pockets enough to drive forward amazing renovation projects, to community-driven projects, you know, projects that are really driven from residents of neighborhoods from the ground up, to technical historic tax credit and historic easement-driven projects. So projects that really wouldn't have been made possible if it weren't for the stacking of different incentives to bring a diverse group of people together, such as the Pythian, an incredible historic building with an incredible past. Amazing African-American historic significance in that structure was sitting empty for years. And the new owners were able to stack different incentives. And now, as a result of that, you have affordable housing, you have market rate housing, you have a food hall, you have a physical therapy studio, all within this one building. It's really incredible.
What's interesting is that you pack in so much of the business of preservation into this beautiful book. You know, you give people lots of tips and lots of kind of sideways suggestions about where to go and how to collaborate and make these things happen. Now, one of the things I adore is the range of the buildings, the churches that have been turned into theaters, and the Hotel Peter and Paul is one of the very first buildings in the book. And then there are restaurants, schools, residential developments, jazz history landmarks. It's all about the creative use of space.
Well, when we were sitting down and looking at all the options of buildings, that was one of the things that we really wanted to show, was that the way people are renovating and restoring our historic architecture in the city really serves new uses. So Hotel Peter and Paul is a great example of that. That is a historic church that was built in the mid 19th century, a school, a convent, and a rectory. It was a massive piece of property that was sitting there vacant for many, many years. And those uses weren't needed in the neighborhood anymore. And having a hotel redevelopment in that neighborhood that also the church space is now an event space, but they also do community Pilates and yoga. Mm-hmm. And so they serve the neighborhood in a new way, which I think is very exciting. It shows that our historic architecture in our neighborhoods grow and adapt with the times, and that the architecture can grow and adapt with the times. Southern Rep Theater in the old St. Rose de Lima church is one of my favorite stories in the book, because it absolutely shows how a building that was so important to that community can still be important to that community. Southern Rep does more than just theater productions. They do community programs mm-hmm. for children and other outreach. So it's still serving a need.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Danielle Del Sol and Susan Langenhennig about Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans. Talk a little bit about the photographs in this. You know the photographer well.
I do. The photographer is Chris Granger. And yes, I am a little biased. He is my husband. However, he is a professional photojournalist and really has a specialty in doing architectural photography and has for many years. The stories in the book were written by Danielle, John Pope, and myself. And while I am a word girl and love all the prose, it's the photos that people will pick up this book and want to keep turning the pages. The photography is beautiful. One thing when we first started the book is we had a conversation with Chris and we said, we've seen 100 pictures of New Orleans, hundreds of pictures of New Orleans. How do we make pictures of New Orleans in these buildings look different and resonate with people who are here and seen the Sanger a million times? The Sanger is the first building profiled in the book. And his point of view was that he really wanted to show it from different angles and different perspectives. And even if you've been in the Sanger hundreds of times, you will still be drawn to these photos, because he got up on near the ceiling and climbed all around it and shot the details that when you're coming in for a theater production, you just miss. Mm-hmm. And so it really brings these buildings to life in a way that I think people will be intrigued with.
And such a wonderful combination of grand views and up-close details.
Right.
You know, there's the variety of the photographs is so wonderful, too. So let's talk a little bit about some of the cautionary tales in this book. And those would be John Pope's obituaries for lost buildings. Mm-hmm. Well, so sad.
I know. Well, that was another chapter where determining which buildings to put in it was tough. Mm-hmm. John, Danielle, and I sat together and really brainstormed, because there's so many buildings. The point of that chapter to me was that it shows what happens when we don't have historic preservation. It also mm-hmm. makes you go, in hindsight, people didn't realize what they were losing when they were losing it. But now, years later, we can look back and go, oh my goodness, how did we let that happen? Yeah. It makes me think today, what are we looking at today that are potentially going to be demolished? Mm-hmm. That we're not even that's not resonating right now, mm-hmm. but maybe will be in a few years. Mm-hmm. It really, those buildings range the gamut too. We have buildings such as the Dillard Sarpy House, which was torn down for the Camp Street down ramp off of the bridge, the Giono Bridge, and that was torn down many, many years ago. It was a early 1800s plantation farmhouse. And now it's where the World War II Museum is today.
Right.
But then you also have ones like the St. Francis Cabrini Church after Hurricane Katrina, which is one that's a little challenging, because that was a modernist building designed by Curtis and Davis. And Holy Cross School moved into that location, which was definitely a benefit to the neighborhood. But it was also at the loss of a very historic building that mm-hmm. meant something to that community. So they're interesting.
And then the St. Charles Hotel, which, of course, mm-hmm. I love, because so many writers stayed mm-hmm. there and wrote about it. Mm-hmm. So it's this really storied hotel. And then the first main library. Yes. It's just heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. It is. I think the before and afters, for people to visually understand what was once here that is now gone, that's the other thing that's going to really pull people into this book, to help understand why we do what we do and why historic preservation matters. Yes, it's an economic driver. Yes, people come to New Orleans to visit and to live because we look and feel like New Orleans. That's why preservation is important. But I've been doing this for many years. I've never heard anybody say, man, we really shouldn't have preserved that building or brought that back. However, I have heard, can you believe that they tore this down or we lost this? It's something that we fight on a weekly basis. People are still tearing down buildings, buildings that have lasted 120, 150 years, multiple hurricanes, termites. They're still getting torn down. We need people to understand how precious our historic architecture is, that it is paramount to who we are as New Orleanians and what the city is.
Avoid future regret, preserve now.
Exactly.
That's a wonderful motto.
I know.
We've been talking with Danielle Del Sol and Susan Langenhennig. You can hear more about Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans when Susan, John Pope, and Chris Granger discuss and sign it Saturday, November 16th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mickey Pfeffer is a visiting scholar at Nicholls State University and the author of the award-winning Southern Ladies and Suffragists, Julia Ward Howe and Women's Rights at the 1884 New Orleans World's Fair. Research for that book led to her new one, which is A New Orleans Author in Mark Twain's Court, Letters from Grace King's New England Sojourns. Mickey Pfeffer, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So tell us about the path to this book and the way it grew out of that first book of yours.
I was looking for first-person accounts for the women's department at the Cotton Centennial. Mm-hmm. And I came across Grace King's letters at the Hill Library at LSU. And I read just that period, but her letters were so snarky and gossipy and fascinating that I thought, oh, I want to come back to this woman. She didn't participate in the women's department, but she nattered from the sidelines about everything that was going on and all the gossip about the background material. So I knew she knew her city and her people and that I would come back to her. After I moved on from the last book, I went back and just started transcribing her letters, really for pleasure at first. And there are hundreds and hundreds of them. And not only have her family saved hers, but the whole family's letters are there. So you get this whole roiling family saga that is just so delicious. And she's such a keen observer. Fortunately for history, not for the family, they couldn't afford to travel together. Only one or two of them could go at a time. So there were always letters going back and forth. And only one of her sisters married. And fortunately, she moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. So Grace King had to tell her sister all that was happening in the city and all the gossip about all the people in the city. So it's perfect.
So what led you to concentrate on this exclusive period in her life?
Well, you know, when you're going to think about publishing, you have to get your hands around some framing mechanism because her letters would take six volumes or so to publish. And I mean, my dream is that all of her letters are published, but I don't expect that to happen. So this suite of letters rose to the top
Came together.
Of the morass of all the transcriptions I was making of this and that period. And suddenly I had something I could have boundaries around.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Mickey Pfeffer, editor of A New Orleans Author in Mark Twain's Court. So talk a little bit about her friendship with Twain, and especially with Livy, Twain's wife.
Almost immediately after she arrived in Hartford, they set out on a train and boat trip up to Frederick Church's home on the Hudson, one of the Hudson River painters. And traveling together, they became more intimate. They spent more time together. And by the time they came back from that trip, she felt that she knew them more personally. They just spent a lot of time back and forth, having dinner together, going back and forth from the houses next door, and playing games, charades. Mark Twain loved to play hearts. They would play into the early hours. Grace King was not a threat to the wives of these men. She befriended the wives.
Of course.
As well.
There's one letter in here that Livy writes to Grace where she said, "I am so longing to have a visit with you. I'll just sit down and have it now." And the visit is the letter.
Right.
And it continues later on that night.
Right.
And those letters really do bring everybody to life.
Right.
What is it about Grace that compels you as a biographer? Because, you know, if you're doing letters, you're doing a kind of biography.
Right.
What is it about her personality?
Well, you know, I must say I didn't necessarily like Grace when I started out, and I found her very judgmental. And what I realized along the way was that I was being judgmental about her judgments. When you read someone's fears and sorrows and pleasures and struggles, you fall in love with their humanness, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, she is just such a keen observer of people and places. No accident that her most well-known book is New Orleans, The Place and the People.
Right.
She just knows how to express herself so wonderfully in letters. And I love when she goes on tears about the people in New England don't even pay any attention to religion or the South or politics. She doesn't understand that they all seem to have these expressions on their faces like everything is just wonderful and, you know, God has blessed us here.
The other thing that you think about is, you know, I think too of Anne Boyd Rue's work on Louisa May Alcott and the constant struggle for money.
Oh.
And she writes at great length about the actual physical labor of writing, you know, what it means to proof a manuscript, what it means to recopy stories, and how little she was paid.
She only made hundreds, not thousands, like Mark Twain. She only ever made hundreds. She was thrilled, however, that she got $150 for her first story. She and her sisters thought, oh, literature really does pay. And then she started figuring out, if I write one every 4 months and I get $150 for it, you know, what that would take. They always struggled with money. Every penny was recorded. They had lost everything during the war, and they never regained it, but they always managed to keep up appearances. That was very important to the genteel poor. Mm-hmm.
And we can still see her house on Coliseum Street.
That's right. I mean, you could even buy it.
Oh, really?
For sale.
Right. Oh, Mickey, that would be
for sale.
Oh, the Grace King Home for Women Writers. I think that would be pretty fabulous.
I know.
So how do you place her in the canon of Southern women writers? Where do you think her rightful place is? Do you think she is appreciated properly?
I think no. She's pretty much out of the canon. She's not anthologized very often. And when she is, it's a story that can be read too easily as racist and not much more. The Little Convent Girl. I think her stories are wonderfully atmospheric. I think her balcony stories are sharp and deft and capture women struggling to make a new life in Reconstruction. She's getting some more attention recently because she wrote about women and their struggles.
Mm-hmm.
So she is getting some scholarly attention.
Well, I wish everybody could see the sparkle in your eyes when you talk about her. It's really great. We've been talking with Mickey Pfeffer, editor of New Orleans Author and Mark Twain's Court, Letters from Grace King's New England Sojourns. You can meet her Wednesday, November 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Mickey, thanks so much.
Susan, thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Megan Holt, Executive Director of Words and Music, a Literary Feast in New Orleans. This four-day celebration of the arts is coming up November 21st through 24th, headquartered at the Ace Hotel, though also at many other venues. Megan, welcome back.
So nice to be back, Susan. Thank you.
So talk about the theme this year, which is mapping change. What has that meant for the programming?
So mapping change really allows Words and Music, which is locally focused, celebrating New Orleans arts in particular, to think about the changing face of our city, which has happened quite drastically these past 10 years or so, and really examine how the arts are interacting with those changes. So we have a session on Poets Respond to Gentrification at the Community Book Center. We have a whole series of programming around the Plessy Ferguson decision, which will end with Joshua Jelly Shapiro debuting a new map to be included in a box set of Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas. And the map is the Plessy Ferguson map. Leona Tate is on that map, and so she'll come in conversation with him and talk about the way that her actions when she was 6 years old and integrated McDonough 19 changed the face of New Orleans. We also have programming on incarceration, which, while not directly linked to the changing face of our city, definitely impacts how our citizens move about in this town. So really looking at where we've been, where we're going, and how that process is happening, who it's impacting, and how the arts can respond to that.
Words and Music has, in recent years, carved out a particular niche in the literary landscape for the sorts of programming you're doing, and that's really important. Mm-hmm. So talk about that process. You're still evolving.
Absolutely. When we decided to take over Words and Music from the Pirates Alley Faulkner Society, we realized we had a unique opportunity because we is One Book One New Orleans, the nonprofit. And we have been working now for 15 years to get books into the hands of adults who struggle with literacy and also to provide free public programming for everyone in New Orleans. We're in 8 to 10 different neighborhoods per year with our programming. But because we've always been an organization that focuses on New Orleans, we realized that if we were going to take on this festival, we had to align the festival with our mission. So now all proceeds from Words and Music go directly towards providing adult literacy resources and free public programming throughout the year. So we became a festival with a purpose. And we also decided to go more locally focused, since that has always been what One Book is about. It's about uplifting our community. Words and Music then had to become about showcasing our arts and the rich talent that we have here. It's incredible. We've got maybe 4 out of a total of 57 speakers who are from out of town. The rest are all local. And even the 4 who are coming from out of town are writing about New Orleans in some way. So it's been a really cool experience to see how outside writers are writing about New Orleans, how New Orleans writers are responding and really putting everyone in conversation with each other.
So talk a little bit about Joshua Jelly Shapiro, who's coming. He wrote a terrific book, Island People, the Caribbean, and the World, which I adore.
Joshua Jelly Shapiro is largely responsible for the Plessy Ferguson map. He will be talking about the process of putting maps together historically and then zeroing in specifically on Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas, which 5 years ago this year was the One Book pick.
Right.
And so when we found out that A, it was the 5th anniversary of that book's pick, and B, there was a new box set coming out with a new map that had never been seen, we had to have him do this.
And then the literature and lunch session at Dookie Chase, which is a perennial favorite.
Absolutely, absolutely. So this year, in honor of the Plessy Ferguson map, we're starting the entire festival off with a Plessy Ferguson tour that will make a stop at Dookie Chase, let some folks out to go get some lunch. And a member of the Chase family will open that session with a discussion about how Dookie Chase became a site of the civil rights movement. There was a lot of activity that went on in that upstairs room.
And then after that, Keith Weldon Medley, who wrote the book We as Freemen about the Plessy Ferguson case, will be in conversation with two descendants of Plessy and Ferguson, Phoebe Ferguson and Keith Plessy. There's a lot of Keiths to keep straight.
We love our living history in New Orleans. We really do.
Absolutely. And that conversation will be facilitated by Reverend Brenda B. Square, who founded the Plessy Ferguson Foundation with the descendants and Keith Weldon Medley.
This is a fun-filled 4 days, and everybody's going to learn a lot, too.
Absolutely. That's the goal.
So words, music, feast.
Yes.
It's all there.
Absolutely.
All right. Where can people go for more information?
Wordsandmusic.org.
All right. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Susan, and I look forward to next year.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, the Lakeshore Branch Library, 1000 West Esplanade in Metairie, hosts a National Novel Writing Month event November 12th, 19th, and Monday, November 25th from 5 to 8:30 p.m. National Novel Writing Month is an annual event that encourages writers to work toward the goal of writing a 50,000-word novel by 11:59 p.m. on November 30th. Florence M. Jubenville discusses and signs her book, Spreading the Gospel of Books, Essie Culver and the Genesis of Louisiana Parish Libraries, Tuesday, November 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Rachel Kushner, author of The Mars Room, The Flamethrowers, and Telex from Cuba, reads from her work Tuesday, November 12th at 6 in the Freeman Auditorium, Woldenberg Art Building at Tulane University. Mickey Pfeffer discusses and signs a New Orleans author in Mark Twain's Court, Letters from Grace King's New England Sojourns, Wednesday, November 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club discusses Pachinko by Minjin Lee, Wednesday, November 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Suzanne Stone discusses and signs New Orleans Coffee, A Rich History, Wednesday, November 13th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Richard Colton discusses and signs his book, No More, No Less, An Artful Cancer Journey, A Remarkable Community, A Rediscovered Purpose. Thursday, November 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Dogfish presents Jamie Attenberg and Roger Kamenetz reading from their work. Thursday, November 14th at 7 at 2448 North Fillory. Anne Babson debuts her new poetry collection, Messiah. Friday, November 15th at 6:30 at L'Union Française, 4522 Britannia Street. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. Saturday, November 16th at 10 at Octavia Books. Susan Langenhennig, John Pope, and Chris Granger discuss and sign their book, Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans. Saturday, November 16th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Coming up this month is Words and Music, a Literary Feast in New Orleans, November 21st through 24th at the Ace Hotel and other locations around town. More details at wordsandmusic.org or go to the Reading Live page at wwno.org for more information as well. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Thank you.